I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. While the death of Freddie Gray and excessive force by police brought demonstrators to the streets of Baltimore, the municipal turbulence has its roots in social and economic conditions, starting with the concentration of poverty at the center of a metro region with one of the highest per capita income levels in the country. Dystopian depictions of Baltimore have made the city seem uniquely bleak, but research shows that compared to other cities and metro areas, Baltimore presents an American story. Concentrated poverty surrounded by affluence, income inequality on a par with other metro areas across the country. Today on Midday, more understanding of Baltimore and a look at an effort to end decades of racial and economic segregation in the inner city. First, the news. Welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. It's the third Wednesday of the month. That means David Zurawick, the Baltimore Sun media critic, will be joining us, paying his monthly visit here today. We'll get a chance to talk with David Zurawick about David Letterman's farewell tonight on CBS after a 33-year run in late-night television. Also, it's the Wednesday after the Sunday of the finale of Mad Men, and you'll get a chance to call in the second hour of the show to talk with David Zurawick, share your thoughts about the finale of that AMC series. The surge in violence continues in Baltimore. Five more shootings overnight, on top of nine yesterday. Most of this violence has occurred since the riots of April 27th. The Western District of the Police Department's Western District now has as many homicides this year, 21, as it had in all of last year. The surge in violence is just one of many very serious subjects that we have discussed here on Midday. We had a chance to discuss this surge in violence yesterday with a Baltimore police sergeant and a young Baltimore city officer. Today, we continue our look inward at Baltimore in the aftermath of the death of Freddie Gray and the riots and the unrest that followed his funeral. We have been having conversations about criminal justice, about economic development or the lack of it in West Baltimore, about the stalled redevelopment of Sandtown Winchester, where Freddie Gray grew up. And as I said yesterday, we spent an hour getting the perspective of a veteran police sergeant and a young officer who's only been on the force for 3 years. Today, we turn back to a subject we addressed last week with urban scholar David Rusk, the high concentration of poor people in inner city Baltimore, and the problem such de facto segregation creates not only for the men, women, and children who live in those conditions, but for the larger city and the larger still metropolitan area. During this hour, we'll be joined by Barbara Samuels, the veteran fair housing attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland, and we'll hear what has been done over the past decade to confront concentrated poverty and provide hundreds of families that want to move to better neighborhoods with better schools an opportunity to do so. Right now, we hold up the mirror to Baltimore with one of its citizens who just happens to work for the Brookings Institution, doing research about Baltimore and other cities. Jennifer Vey is a fellow at the Brookings Institution whose work primarily focuses on the competitiveness and quality of life of cities and metro areas. Jennifer, nice to have you back on the show. Thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
I noticed that at the Brookings Institution, you and your colleague, Alan Berube, and another colleague, Brad McDearman, took it upon yourselves to take all the data that you've been looking at for, years now about Baltimore and other cities and put it in context for people who are looking at Baltimore and thinking, that this is a particularly bleak American city. What you found is that this is a fairly common American city. We'll say an American story. Good fortune, dire poverty, and inequality in Baltimore, an American story. There, I just used the headlines from one of your blog posts. But you say that what's happening here is happening in other cities, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what we really need to look at is I think people are really pretty well aware of the levels of distress in the Sandtown Winchester area where Freddie Gray lived, in other areas within the city of Baltimore. And I think that's a story that the media has well told. But there's a counter story to that, too. And I think that's a story that also really needs to get out there. And that's that, you know, we have these levels of distress in neighborhoods, in a city that's, you know, has many pockets of vibrancy and that is growing and thriving in parts of the city, certainly. And that these neighborhoods reside in a metropolitan area that has some real strengths, even compared to a lot of metros nationwide. So, you know, Baltimore ranks 7th among largest 35 metros in things like per capita income and in income growth. It has a very substantial Black middle class, ranks 2nd among the largest cities. You know, you have a lot of wealthy households. About, you know, even in the city, about 40,000 Baltimore households earned at least $100,000 a year. And, you know, it's a metropolitan area that has a tremendous amount of assets. And so, you know, it's really important to understand the context in which these neighborhoods, again, are located, and to understand that this is, in many ways, a pretty thriving and an affluent metropolitan area. And what's also equally interesting then is, okay, you've got this dichotomy between these very poor neighborhoods and this growing, you know, metro area. And that's the story that you have to look at within the national context, because this is happening in places all over the country.
In fact, Baltimore does better by some measures than a lot of the cities on your list.
It does. It does.
Give us one example of that. We talked about per capita income.
Sure.
That's for the city itself or the metro area?
That's actually for the metro area. And again, if you look at the metro area, you know, on per capita income, on things like educational attainment, look at the downtown and, you know, some of the strong indicators in terms of the population that resides and works in downtown relative to other places. You see that Baltimore actually fares very well on many different indicators compared to other metropolitan areas. And you know, again, that's a story that I think isn't fully getting out there. But, and I think to tell that story, it's not in any way trying to, distract folks from the real problems that exist here. That's certainly not the point. But it's to really, make sure that people understand that you've got this juxtaposition here between high poverty and affluence that is not so dissimilar of what exists in many other places around the country.
If you look at the national press, read stories about Baltimore since April 27th, dystopian depictions of the city that have made Baltimore seem, I said, uniquely bleak, but what we're getting into here is, as you say, an American story, concentrated poverty surrounded by affluence, income inequality on a par with other metro areas around the country. Maryland, if you go further out and just look at the state of Maryland, several times over the years, the census has reported Maryland to be the wealthiest state in terms of median household income in the country. Other times, maybe we're 2nd, 3rd, or 4th. New Jersey's in there somewhere. I think California gets in there sometimes, New York metropolitan area. But Maryland is always there. It's just that its central city, its main city, Baltimore, has affluence, as you say, but it also has dire poverty, highly concentrated poverty.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's exactly right. And, you know, if you look at the city as a whole, its levels of concentrated poverty are actually about, you know, average in terms of American cities.
What do we call concentrated poverty? Is it 40% where 40% of the households in a specific area have high poverty?
Yes, that's how we define it. And I think there are other definitions out there, but that's a pretty standard definition.
Well, use that measure for us. So when you look at that, what do you see in Baltimore?
So Baltimore cities, you know, sort of 51%, ranks 51. It's sort of right in the middle in terms of its concentrated poverty. But then you can look within these neighborhoods and just see, you know, in take Sandtown, Winchester, for example, you know, there you have about 32% of households, you know, are living below the poverty line. That's double the U.S. You know, you have about 48% of the kids, almost 50% of the kids there are impoverished. So the depth of the poverty that exists in some of these neighborhoods is really pretty profound.
Can I go to another chart that you presented on the Black middle class? And you just mentioned it there. You said it is a significant number, and that's for the metro area. Can we look at that for a minute? And I'm curious how that compares to other cities.
Well, Baltimore actually has one of the strongest Black middle classes in the country. I think second only to D.C. But, you know, I think this is part of the issue, too. So it does have, this isn't strictly a racial dynamic, though there's certainly one that exists within these neighborhoods where in neighborhoods like Sandtown, for example, you know, you do have, it's almost solely an African-American population. But, you know, there is this counter story that there's a very strong black middle class as well. Not again, you know, located just in the city, but a lot of the black middle class has left the city over the years, too, and resides in our suburban areas.
Jobs in Baltimore City pay better than the national average. That's chart number three here. That might surprise some people.
Yeah, I think it probably does. And part of that, you know, you have to put in sort of the national economic context. We're located in the Northeast, which tends to have, you know, in many cities in this part of the country tend to pay better wages. But I think what it does do is sort of counter this idea that, you know, wages are really depressed here, that the whole city is, you know, is poor or impoverished. That's obviously not at all the case. Rather, you're just seeing this dichotomy that we've been talking about.
I'm interested in your thoughts on this because one of the things you look at is competitiveness. Economic competitiveness of areas. You and Alan Berube have looked at this. So when it comes to that, when you have this dichotomy, you know, highly concentrated, high poverty areas in the inner city, surrounded by, you know, some middle class and then some affluence, and then further out in the region, more affluence, what consequences does that have for a region in terms of its competitiveness? I ask you because I got an email, or actually a Facebook posting from one of our listeners in Howard County who said, and I mentioned this last week when David Rusk was here, that, you know, we're thriving out here in Howard County. It's the city that has the problems. Don't look at us. There's no drag on us out here because of Baltimore City.
I think that's part of the issue. And I think it leads to a level of complacency. I mean, when you have a region that has as many strengths as the Baltimore region does, I think what happens is it makes people be able to say, well, the problem doesn't really exist for me. I'm doing fine. I've got a good job. I have a high income. And I think that's part of the issue. Now, but I think if you look over the long haul, you know, I think that's something that we really need to start pulling apart and saying, you know, to what extent does the poverty in these neighborhoods ultimately have an impact on the broader region? And, you know, I think that's an area that's ripe for a lot of research to really understand, dichotomy is.
Well, what would you look at if you were looking at that? That's interesting.
Sure. Well, you know, and part of it is, you know, what are the spillover effects, I think, in some of these neighborhoods? And I think that exists certainly in the city to some extent, both in reality and perception, to the extent that you have very, you know, deep pockets of distress and the violent crime and some of the social issues that come with that. That is a deterrent, no doubt, for investment in those particular neighborhoods and probably for some of the surrounding neighborhoods as well. And I think it also leads then to you know, perception issues about the city, whether they're perceptions within our region, you know, of people thinking, hey, that's a place I don't want to go or I don't want to invest in, and certainly even outside the region. And I think that's, you know, partly you want to, that's why you want to tell both sides of the story that, yes, we have these areas of distress, but we have a lot of other things going on here in Baltimore.
Taxes would be an ingredient in that, wouldn't it?
Sure. I think, yeah.
I mean, taxes in order to, for instance, for Baltimore City schools, for children who come to school, you can go through this whole process. Children who come to school with deficits, who need more help,
Absolutely.
Who need more attention, and a city that doesn't have the tax base to support the school system needs the help of the state. I mean, that's one way that people in the region pay for it.
Sure, and that's a well discussed issue here in the city where we have very high property taxes. And, you know, how do you get out of that cycle where if you don't have the investment, you know, the employer base to be able to continually increase your tax base, you're then having to put that burden on the existing businesses and residents that are here, which means, you know, one, it can be a deterrent for people or businesses, you know, to locate here. At the same time, you know, as you noted, then we have a lot of the social issues and the educational issues and the criminal justice issues that we need to pay for. And so you've got this issue where, you know, you're taxing the folks that are here, but and, you know, and where ultimately, you know, the solution is we need to continue to build that tax base. And how do you go about doing that?
You know, the research that you would be doing in this hypothetically, you'd be measuring something that doesn't exist, right? You'd be trying to measure what type of economic growth could there be but for the problems in Baltimore City, but for the high concentration of poverty, but for the crime rate, right?
Sure. And there has been work done, I think, on the inequality issue, particularly to what extent does inequality impact, you know, regional growth, job growth, and other indicators. But there's not a ton out there. There's certainly been more localized research on, for example, the influence of vacant properties on housing values. There's been a decent amount of work done to show that where you have areas with high levels of vacancy and abandonment, how that then has almost a cancerous effect on the surrounding neighborhoods in terms of bringing down those values. And that's something clearly the city is well aware of and is trying to address through programs like the Vacants to Values program.
Jennifer Vey is with us from the Brookings Institution. She lives here in Baltimore City, and she knows her stuff. If you have a question, please give us a ring as we go through some more of the charts and graphs put out by the Brookings Institution. You can find a link to their blog on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Next up, more than 7,000 low-income Baltimore families are on a waiting list for public assistance to move away from high-poverty neighborhoods. We'll hear about one of the most important federal court settlements in Baltimore's long history of racial segregation and how that settlement has quietly helped hundreds of men, women, and children move to better neighborhoods and schools throughout the region. Please stay with us. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. Our guest in this hour of the show, Jennifer Vey, a fellow with the Brookings Institution who studies Baltimore and other cities. You know, we mentioned jobs downtown. That's an interesting measure, Jennifer. Baltimore ranks 9th among major metropolitan downtowns on population and 12th on jobs, downtown jobs. I mean, this is interesting to me. Downtown population of the primary city in the 25 largest U.S. metro areas, Baltimore is 9th. Ahead of us, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, Philly, L.A., Seattle, Boston, and Washington. Just behind us, San Diego and Denver. And then you look at employment downtown. That's another interesting number. Would you mind sharing that with our listeners, where Baltimore ranks?
Sure. 12th, actually, in terms of its employment downtown. So what this is really showing between these population employment numbers is that we have, you know, a pretty healthy downtown, and it's been one that's been growing as well. The Downtown Partnership and others have been putting out some good data, you know, showing how we've had increasing numbers of residents moving downtown. We're seeing, you know, if you go downtown, you see a lot of those apartment buildings that are coming online, being filled up with millennials and others who are really interested in having a more urban kind of lifestyle.
Here's an email from Carol, who points out that one of the biggest problems Baltimore faces is that it is an independent city, the largest such in the U.S. This means that it is not politically integrated with the surrounding county or counties as other large cities are. Those surrounding counties have no direct fiscal responsibility to or for the city. So we are unique there. I think maybe there's only one other city like that.
Yeah, there's, I think Richmond might be like that, and St. Louis.
Is Chicago in Cook County?
Yeah, I believe
yeah,
that
Chicago's
it is.
In
right?
There's
yeah.
an example of so, a city right. in a county, right?
So, and I think there's two issues sort of embedded here. On one hand, that's exactly right, where you're an independent city and you're not part of a jurisdiction with your surrounding county, and that has all sorts of implications. And then, you know, we're a geographically bounded city. If you compare Baltimore City with some of your more sprawling kind of cities with a much larger physical footprint in, you know, the Southwest, for example, in some ways you wind up getting these apples and oranges comparison. I mean, if you put Baltimore City and Baltimore County together, just those numbers, let alone some of the surrounding jurisdictions, you know, and then we're ranking them against other places, I think some of the numbers would look pretty different.
Let's take a quick call before we introduce our second guest in this hour of the show, Suzanne in Ellicott City in Howard County. Thanks for calling Midday.
Hi, thanks, Dan. Hey, I just was going to take sort of great offense at the caller or the email Facebook user from Howard County who talked about how we're doing great here and there's no poverty here and things are swell here. I teach at the alternative middle and high school for the Howard County public school system. And we have 160 students currently registered. Of those 160, more than 70% receive free and reduced meals. More than 15%, as of today, are characterized as homeless. More than 20% are living in multifamily residences, which they're basically living with a grandmother, an aunt, an uncle, somebody who is not, you know, somebody who's not their primary caregiver in order to access the services of Howard County Public Schools. We've got kids who are the first in their family to graduate from high school. We just celebrated our senior celebration last Thursday night, and we have 30 kids who will walk across the stage at their home high school, in a Long Reach or Oakland Mills or whatever school they were sent to Homewood from. But three now, I think, are the first of their families who have ever graduated from high school. I've got two eighth graders this year who are the first of their family to complete the eighth grade. So there is poverty in Howard County. I believe it's much more of a race issue. I'm sorry, a class issue than a race issue, because our population trends about 50-50 with African-American and white students. So we do have a very small demographic of several Asian kids and several kids who are of Hispanic background. But
Suzanne,
primarily,
thank you for calling. I just want to say the last time Jennifer Vey was on Midday, I think we were here to discuss the increase in poverty levels in suburban areas around Baltimore, right?
Well, actually, some of my colleagues have done some real work on that. Elizabeth Niebone and Ellen Berube.
Elizabeth.
She has led a lot with Alan a lot of our work around suburban poverty, and it is an issue we're seeing. You know, for a long time, I think, thought of a lot of our most pressing poverty issues as being something that was limited to cities. And that's clearly not the case. Not that it's ever fully been the case, but if you look over the last, you know, decade, we've really seen an increase nationally in the amount of suburban poverty. And in fact, it's actually a somewhat less of an issue here in the Baltimore region than it is in other areas of the country where this is really a pretty dominant trend. That's not to say that we don't have, you know, issues in our surrounding counties as well, though, as the caller pointed out.
Let me just add this. Norman Augustine, the former CEO of Lockheed Martin, who was on Midday a few weeks ago, he headed a state commission on business, making Maryland more business friendly. He says it's not acceptable that in one of the wealthiest states in the country, 44% of our public school kids qualify for free or reduced lunches because their families are poor. Quote, that's not a formula for success in the long term, he said. And he said, you know, that the state ought to be looking at adequately funding K-12 education to address income inequality. That from the former CEO of Lockheed Martin. I just wanted to add that here. But still, I mean, suburban poverty levels nowhere near compared to Baltimore City's, correct? Overall and concentrated.
Sure, overall. And I think particularly when you look at these issues of concentrated poverty, it is something that isn't fully unique to Baltimore. But if you look nationally at the levels of suburban poverty, it's not quite the same dynamic here.
Jennifer Vey is a fellow with the Brookings Institution. Now we welcome back to Midday Barbara Samuels. Barbara Samuels, a senior attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland, who has worked long and hard on fair housing issues. Foremost, the federal class action case known as Thompson v. HUD that we discussed on the air a little bit last week with David Rusk. In January 2005, after a decade of litigation, a federal judge here found that the Department of Housing and Urban Development had violated federal law by concentrating African-American public housing residents in the most impoverished, segregated areas of the city. It was Judge Marvin Garbus. He said HUD had treated Baltimore as, quote, an island reservation for use as a container for all of the poor of a contiguous region, end quote. He ruled that HUD must implement an effective regional strategy for promoting fair housing opportunities for African-American public housing residents throughout the Baltimore region. Now, that was a good 10 years ago, and there was a follow-up settlement 3 years ago in 2012. Barbara Samuels is here to explain some of this to us and talk a little bit about the progress that's been made there. Barbara, nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Dan. It's nice to be back.
We talked about this from my column last week. The number 2,800 represents what at this point?
Well, since the program started as a result of a prior partial settlement of the case, the program started in about June of 2004. And during the period of time since then, about 2,800 families have received vouchers along with counseling supports to help them find housing and then to follow up with them for 2 years after they make a move. And they've been moving from Baltimore City public housing and from some of the most impoverished neighborhoods in Baltimore throughout the region into areas that have, you know, better schools, lower poverty rates, more racially integrated, and you know, lower levels of crime and violence. So this has just been gradually going on, you know, for the last 11 or 12 years. As a result of the settlement, will be, you know, HUD acknowledged that the program had been successful and that there was a desire to see it, continue and expand. And so over the period 2012 to 2018, they're providing an additional 400 vouchers per year so that additional families can similarly make this kind of move, which is for many people really life-changing, but especially in terms of its impact on children and the kind of neighborhoods in which they grow up.
These families receive a voucher that helps them pay rent in areas that are not high poverty or even moderate poverty. This is a carefully managed program. So where can you use the vouchers?
So we're looking for areas that are low poverty.
Low poverty.
So 10% poverty or less, that are racially integrated, that that have other indicators of opportunity. So we're looking for areas that have strong schools, lower rates of free and reduced lunch in the schools, higher school performance, more qualified teachers. We also look at the crime rates. We look at the employment opportunities. So there's been various efforts underway in the region to actually map opportunity using these, you know, various indicators that the experts, you know, have said are, you know, good indicators of where is a neighborhood that provides economic mobility for families and a good environment for raising children.
Barbara Samuels, does Thompson v. HUD partly explain the increase in poverty, people who are considered low income or poverty living in suburban areas?
Well, no. I mean, we are talking about a very large metropolitan area. And so the number of people who are moving are compared to the, you know, population in these areas, it's really pretty negligible. And as Jennifer said, Baltimore is a little bit unique in terms of the national trends of suburbanization of poverty. Our suburbs actually have the fourth lowest poverty rate in the entire country. And while you would expect the poverty rate in the suburbs to have increased during the Great Recession, as people who already lived in the suburbs lost jobs and became poorer, and that did happen to a certain extent. But our poverty rate barely inched up in the suburbs at all. It went up fairly dramatically in the city, so that a lot of the gains that the city had made in reducing poverty earlier in the 2000s were largely erased during the recession.
I think one of the things we reported based on your colleague Elizabeth Kneebone's research was that there were as many people who were considered poor by the federal government living in suburban counties, plural, as there are in the city now, something like that.
Yes,
we reached at that point a couple years ago, but they dispersed all through the region.
Right, and it's always been the case that there has been poverty in the suburbs. In fact, in our region, over quite a few decades, 60% of poor whites have always lived in the suburbs. So there's a great disparity. While there are issues of class, there are also issues of race in terms of one of the products of segregation is that low-income whites are able to live throughout the metropolitan area. Their children attend suburban schools. They live in areas where most of the job growth has occurred over the last three or four decades and is still occurring. And so those children grow up in a very different environment than do black children who, as a result of segregation, are living in areas of concentrated poverty. Even a fair number of middle class African American families live in areas where there is a much higher rate of poverty than where middle class, white families live of the same economic strata. So their kids are much more exposed to poverty, even if they themselves are not poor.
I also mentioned earlier in the show, 7,100 people who are on a waiting list for vouchers, evidence of a desire to move from poor neighborhoods.
That's just the waiting list for this particular mobility program. There are also the Housing Authority of Baltimore City recently opened its waiting list for the first time since 2003, and I think they received about 75,000 applications and selected 25,000 families by a lottery to go on their waiting list. Suburban counties also have large waiting lists. So, you know, what we've seen is that federal assistance for housing has, you know, just been eroded tremendously over the years. But especially with the shifts in the economy leading to more low-wage service work, the incomes have not kept pace with rising rents. We have some of the highest rent growth in this region. And so you've got people all over this region who are experiencing what we call rent burden, paying, you know, a high proportion of their income for rent, which tends to put people at risk for homelessness at worst, and certainly is very destabilizing and destabilizing for children. You know, children really need a safe and stable environment to live in, so that even if you're not homeless, if you're moving from house to house to house every year, that's very destabilizing for children's welfare.
We've done a couple of programs on the need for more affordable housing in the Baltimore region. And I guess one of the things you're looking at is capacity. If people have vouchers, they need to have a place to use them, right?
Well, they do. And it's not that there hasn't been a growth in the supply of rental housing in the region. In fact, in the last few years, there's been a boom in construction of rental housing.
Since the rent's too high.
And part of that is actually deliberate. So in Towson, for instance, they are in the midst of a multifamily building boom. They're trying to become dense, and they're describing it as wanting to be like another Bethesda. Well, Bethesda is a very affluent and very white place. So that if that's the goal, is to become Bethesda, it's probably not surprising that out of the 2,500 new multifamily units that have been added in Towson or are in the construction pipeline now, not a single one of them has been designed to be affordable housing.
They don't have inclusionary zoning in Baltimore County. It's not required.
They have no inclusionary zoning to require it, and they appear to make no effort to include it.
Barbara Samuels with us from the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland. Jennifer Vey from the Brookings Institution. You're listening to Midday. Comments or questions on what you've heard so far are welcome. When we get back, more with Jennifer Vey on the research on Baltimore, holding up a mirror to Baltimore to see what we look like in terms of our social conditions, economic conditions, and education. I want to talk about a little bit about that when we get back. And more on housing, affordability, and breaking up the highly segregated neighborhoods in Baltimore through this federal court settlement with Barbara Samuels of the ACLU. If you have questions about any of that, please give us a ring now, 410-662-8780. Our email address for Midday, you can send comments that way, midday@wypr.org. Still ahead on today's Midday, as talk show host David Letterman says farewell to his mostly baby boomer audience, Baltimore Sun TV critic David Zurawiec reflects on Letterman's record-setting 33-year run on late-night television. And what did you think of the Mad Men finale on Sunday night? Please share your thoughts in the second hour of Midday after the news at 1. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Jennifer Vey, who lives in Baltimore, works for the Brookings Institution. She's a fellow there and does a lot of research on metropolitan areas and cities, quality of life, competitiveness of cities and metro areas across the country. Taking a look at Baltimore today. And Barbara Samuels joining us from the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland to give us an update on Thompson v. HUD, the federal court case, class action case. It goes back 20 years to the time when we had high-rise public housing projects in Baltimore that have now disappeared, were demolished. And then the court order saying, you've got to do something about this. You can't continue to have this concentrated, segregated racially and economically segregated public housing in Baltimore City. I meant to ask Jennifer Vey before we closed out the hour today. I was curious about education levels in our area relative to income and success in life. So what does that look like? What's the Baltimore City and the region look like?
Sure. Well, you know, if you look at the region overall, there are actually pretty high educational attainment levels, meaning, you know, people who have a BA or people who have a graduate degree. But there's disparities there, certainly, as well, both between, you know, city and suburb, but also, you know, particularly between whites and African Americans. So if you look at the city, for example, you know, about, you know, almost 50% of whites have a bachelor's degree, less than 14% of African Americans do. So you can really see that you know, you have these disparities, which obviously contributes to people's ability to get, you know, higher paying employment.
We were talking also about with Barbara Samuels about mobility, basically upward mobility, the ability to people to move. Well, first of all, wherever they want to live where they can, if they need some help from need public assistance to do that, it's provided for them ostensibly because they'll do better in life, maybe make more money. Their kids will make more money, do better in school, make more money eventually. That in theory. And we're wondering whether that's the case or not. Does that happen? Finally, now we have some research from Harvard economists that suggests, it does happen some places in the country. Baltimore is not doing so well in that regard.
That's right, Dan. I mean, Raj Chetty and his colleagues at Harvard, who have been doing a series of studies on economic mobility and inequality in the United States, in the midst of the whole uprising and Freddie Gray crisis, issued a study that was very telling about Baltimore, in that it found that overall Baltimore ranks 100 out of 100 of the largest jurisdictions in the country for economic mobility for poor children. But we also ranked low for economic mobility for non-poor children. One of the things that they found was that the places that provide economic mobility for poor children are also places that provide more economic mobility for all children. And so it's not a zero-sum game where, you know, if my child has more economic mobility, your child will have less. It's that it creates an environment. If you have an environment that promotes economic mobility, it will promote it for all children.
Since I mentioned Howard County, and we got a call from there. So following this, what Raj Chetty is showing with his research, and by the way, he's going to be a guest on our show tomorrow in the noon hour. If you grow up in Howard County, even if you're poor or borderline poor middle class, if you're in that environment, a more affluent environment, schools, you're going to do better in life overall than the kid who's born in Sandtown, Winchester.
He released a companion study at the same time that was based on the old Moving to Opportunity experiment of the 1990s. And what it found was that children who had moved to a less poor area when they were young, before the age of 12, had on average 30% more income when they were in their mid-20s than children who had not moved. And the length of their exposure to these lower poverty neighborhoods each year made a difference. So the longer they were in a low poverty neighborhood, the more of a boost that gave to their earnings as adults.
Hmm.
So
when someone says, Barbara Samuels, you got all these vouchers and you're moving poor people out of inner city Baltimore, East Baltimore, West Baltimore, and they're going to low poverty areas, you're just moving a problem from one place to another. It's not true, actually.
It's not true.
Especially when it comes to kids.
Yeah, and interestingly, part of what they found was the tax revenue from the increased earnings of these kids more than offset the cost of providing this assistance to them.
Wow.
So over the long haul, and we don't always take a long view, it was actually more beneficial to taxpayers to have children growing up, you know, with more chance for economic mobility than to just have persistent intergenerational poverty with people stuck in place.
Another question for you, Barbara Samuels. If there are 7,100 people waiting for vouchers, you get another 400 per year for the next 3 years, 4 years? That still doesn't fill that need. When we talked about this last week, and David Rusk was here, after David Rusk left, somebody wanted to know, well, what happens to those neighborhoods? If so many poor people actually move out of Baltimore and are dispersed throughout the area, that's great. But what happens to those neighborhoods after they are they become abandoned and the people who are stuck there are really stuck with even more abandonment?
Well, you're asking a complex question. And my first reaction, you know, because people often ask that question, is what about the children? You know, if a house is on fire.
Oh, I'm not saying that they should stay.
I understand.
I'm saying people wonder, you know, what happens if you empty out, you know, 4 or 5 square blocks of very poor people?
Well, it doesn't operate that way.
It doesn't actually work like that,
no,
does it?
No. And the reality, tragically, is that we're talking in many cases, such as Sandtown, about neighborhoods that have already emptied out, that have lost 50% or more of their population over the last couple of decades. And so, you know, that is the bigger driver of abandonment. You know, those are neighborhoods that unfortunately don't have a housing market. They don't have demand. One of the least known aspects of the Thompson settlement, people talk about the mobility program, is that under Thompson, we also put 100 units of scattered site housing into Sandtown Winchester in the 1990s as part of the Enterprise and Baltimore City neighborhood transformation effort there. And unfortunately, you know, within 7 or 8 years, a third of those units were vacant again, as were other units that were rehabilitated during that period of time.
And why did that happen, Barbara?
That's a product of the fact that you've got no market demand in those neighborhoods. And so when you do housing construction or housing rehabilitation there, people who already live in that neighborhood or maybe, you know, next door in Harlem Park, they will move into the better housing. And somewhere down the line, another house will go vacant.
Unless you're then growing the number of households in the city overall, and that's certainly something that's a major ambition of the current administration here, is to grow the number of households so that you can increase demand, you know, for housing in the city overall.
Let me ask you both this question. I saw a Princeton study that looked at hyper-segregated metropolitan areas, and Baltimore was one of them, a hyper-segregated city. New York's in there, Philadelphia's in there, Cleveland, I forget the full list. First of all, do you believe, does the map, do the demographics make us look hyper-segregated? And how do you get out of that? You do it bit by bit, I guess, through Thompson versus HUD, but overall, it must be a very hard thing to change, obviously.
Well, you have to be deliberate and conscious about it, you know, and, you know, often people say, well, isn't that social engineering?
Right.
It's actually the reverse. It's reverse social engineering. The social engineering that occurred through a whole litany of government policies, many of which have been discussed in the mass media over the last, you know, 2 or 3 weeks since the uprising here in Baltimore. That was the social engineering that very deliberately caused these patterns of segregation that then resulted in these patterns of concentrated poverty. So there are strategies that can be used. And in fact, Baltimore has just put together, not just Baltimore City, but the Baltimore region has produced a regional housing plan. under the auspices of the Baltimore Metropolitan Council and a collaboration of all the jurisdictions in the region, as well as the Greater Baltimore Committee and nonprofit groups and philanthropic and educational institutions called the Opportunity Collaborative.
I've heard of that. I don't know much about it. I mean, but is the idea to change laws to make this happen?
It's not so much a question of changing laws.
Or zoning?
Zoning is one of the main vehicles of social engineering by which neighborhoods are stratified and divided into rich and poor. And because of the connection in our country between poverty and race, it's one of the main drivers of segregation. So certainly that is dealing with zoning by curbing exclusionary large lot zoning.
That's what I mean. I mean going the other way toward more inclusionary zoning that allows more density and as long as you provide affordable housing. Is that part of their strategy or not?
Yeah, that is part of it. And, you know, we just saw an incident in Anne Arundel County earlier this year.
We discussed it here on the show. Yeah, where you might the Enterprise Homes Project.
Right, where some efforts to have an exception to you know large lot zoning for workforce housing led to repeal of the portion of the workforce housing law in Anne Arundel County that allowed it to be built in areas zoned for one or two houses.
Yeah, we devoted some time to that very thing.
But I do think, you know, on this point about the Opportunity Collaborative, one of the other things is what they're focusing on isn't just housing, but they're also focusing on transportation, you know, being able to connect people, particularly to job opportunities within the region, but also workforce is a major, the other sort of major third component of that. And we haven't talked a lot about that here, but I think when we're talking about how do you move people up and out of poverty, either you know raising their incomes and they stay in place and use that money as we all do to invest in our homes and our neighborhoods, or where they use that money to leave the neighborhood and move to someplace else. Certainly, the crux of this is how do you do that, you know, and it's the answer to that I think is obviously extremely complicated, but a big part of it is you know in a region that is growing, that has a strong employment base, that has a lot of, you know, good paying industries, how do you then connect people up into them through education, through workforce programs, you know, particularly, as well as the physical connectivity
Right. Good public transportation, which is another subject we'll be taking on in the show next week Jimmy Rouse is joining us, right? Yeah, to talk about that, among other guests.
Well, in addition to connecting people to jobs, and particularly the suburban job centers, because some of the big suburban job centers like Hunt Valley and the area around the airport and down by Fort Meade, in addition to transportation, you connect people to those jobs by building affordable housing as you build jobs and as you build new neighborhoods, that if you include affordable housing in it, people have access to
those. And of course, the flip side of that is making sure that we continue to grow jobs here in the city where a lot of people already live, right? And making sure that this job growth, and we have had a lot of job sprawl in this region, and that's part of the issue, no doubt. And it's important to be growing jobs in our suburban communities as well, but we really want to ensure that we're growing, you know, quality jobs within the city.
And that you have a workforce that has become skilled and educated.
And is able to connect into those jobs.
Still a lot of work to do there. Because probably nothing, we're down to our last minute of this hour with Jennifer and Barbara, but nothing probably would close these gaps of income inequality more than that. We always come back to the E word, education, I think. We seem to do that on this show all the time. I think you would agree with that.
Particularly early education is what the research is showing. And there's actually some good news in the paper this morning. We're starting to see a payoff in Baltimore City from efforts to have full day pre-K and closing, as one of my colleagues was quoted, closing the achievement gap before it starts.
Barbara Samuels from the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland. So nice to have you on the show again, Barbara. Thank you for the information.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was great to have you. And Jennifer Vey, thank you for coming back to Midday.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, nice to have you on the show again. Jennifer Vey is a fellow at the Brookings Institution, has done a lot of research on Baltimore and other cities, and we posted some of the recent postings by Brookings about Baltimore on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. You can find a link to it there. I want to thank our lunch contributor today. We have lunch today from Kenilworth Farmers Market. Kenilworth Farmers Market, located next to Atwater's at the Shops at Kenilworth in Towson, open Tuesdays 3:30 to 6 p.m., May through November 24th. Vendors offer seasonal organic fruits, vegetables, meats, eggs, bread, pastries, honey, flowers, wine, coffee. More information at thekenilworthmarket.com. Thanks for lunch, folks. Stay tuned for the second hour of Midday, please.